There, do you have any idea what you're listening to?
London Philharmonic?
It's Venus.
Huh?
Venus.
Why not? We've bounced signals off the moon's surface. There's no reason that Venus shouldn't radiate impulses.
I don't mean the static. Can't you hear it, the other thing?
What other thing?
Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Reese, and I'm your host. On today's program, a big news wrap-up. We're going to catch up on a whole bunch of different things that have been going on in our media environment, including finally finding out what happened to those indie media servers that were taken by the federal government in October of 2004. We'll also see, will the FCC ever get some new commissioners? And lots of other things. So you do want to stay tuned. On October 7th, 2004, over 20 indie media websites were taken offline when the computer hard drives they were stored on were given over to U.S. government authorities by the Rackspace Company, which was providing internet hosting services for the sites. After the seizure, there was absolute silence coming from both the U.S. government and Rackspace. The Electronic Frontier Foundation, which is representing indie media in the matter, filed a motion to unseal documents related to the seizure, and finally on August 1st of this year, these documents were delivered to the EFF. According to the released documents, on or around Thursday, October 7th, Rackspace was served with a commissioner's subpoena pursuant to 28 United States Code 1782 and a mutual legal assistance treaty. A commissioner's subpoena is a special subpoena issued by the district court in which the entity holding the requested information resides. Since Rackspace is based in San Antonio, this would be the court in the Western District of Texas. Ordinarily, an assistant United States attorney for the relevant district is appointed as the commissioner and is empowered under the statute to issue a subpoena. While Rackspace had refused to provide a copy of the seizure order or even discuss its contents in October 7, 2004 email, Rackspace explained to IndyMedia that it had received a federal order to provide the hardware to the requesting agency. The hardware was seized the same day, and all the news media and other material on the AMESA servers was silenced around 1718 GMT on October 7, 2004. Rackspace later said it was legally barred from discussing the seizure. However, according to the EFS, the released documents contradict that claim. Even though the subpoena originated in Texas, the servers in question were actually located in a Rackspace facility in London, England. An investigation is underway to determine if Rackspace UK's actions violated any UK laws. Specific details as to what particular websites hosted on these servers were being sought have been redacted from the released documents. However, the documents do confirm that a request for information came from Italian authorities as part of an ongoing criminal investigation. Yet Italian authorities and the U.S. government had only requested, quote, log files in relation to the creation and updating, end quote, of websites, not the server hard drives themselves. So why did Rackspace turn over IndyMedia hard drives to the government, taking 20 regional websites offline? Rackspace is claiming it was a mistake. In an email to CNET News, spokeswoman Annalie Drush said, quote, a Rackspace employee mistakenly used the word hardware to describe the contents of a federal order, end quote. She goes on to explain, quote, in order to comply with the mandated deadline, Rackspace delivered copy drives to the FBI. Shortly thereafter, Rackspace succeeded in isolating and extracting the relevant files responsive to the subpoena and immediately asked that the drives be returned by the FBI, end quote. But if it was only copy drives that were delivered to the FBI, then why were the websites taken offline? EFF attorney Kurt Opsahl told CNET that Rackspace's actions are, quote, like getting a subpoena for one document in a warehouse of documents, and instead of turning over that document, they turned over the entire warehouse. End quote. In a press release, the EFF asks, quote, did government agents intentionally mislead the web host into thinking it had to hand over complete copies of the Indie Media servers? End quote. I'm sure we can guarantee that Indie Media and the EFF will be looking more into this situation. And you are listening to Media Geek. Check us out online at www.mediageek.org. We'll be back in one moment. And welcome back to Media Geek. The FCC has approved 30 new low-power FM radio stations that some low-power radio activists claim are too close to a large network of stations that some call the clear channel of Christian radio. Although not typically mentioned in the same breath as commercial radio giants like Clear Channel and Infinity, CSN International and the Calvary Chapel Church of Twin Falls, Idaho, are giants in the Christian broadcasting world. CSN operates 404 stations, all fed by satellite from its main station, KAWZ, in Twin Falls. 360 of these are so-called translator stations, which are low-power non-commercial stations that may only rebroadcast the signal of a full-power station. But in 2004, the FCC put on hold 30 applications for low-power FM stations filed by Calvary Chapel churches, because the applications were all nearly exact duplicates of each other and closely resembled applications previously filed by CSN, operated by the Calvary Chapel of Twin Falls. The National Lawyers Guild Committee on Democratic Communications filed a request with the FCC to have the applications dismissed. LPFM is required to be a locally owned and operated service that may not be part of a network. The CDC argued that the cookie-cutter nature of the Calvary Chapel applications gave the appearance that they would be operated as part of a co-owned network, similar to CSN. But on July 22nd of this year, the FCC decided in favor of the Calvary Chapel applications, after allowing the applicants to submit additional documentation to demonstrate that the stations would be locally owned, operated, and programmed. The FCC concluded, quote, that each applicant provides its respective community with a variety of programs and activities in the areas of religious education, fellowship, youth programs, and strengthening family and social values, and is therefore eligible to become an LPFM station licensee, end quote. Although the commission said that it wasn't an important fact in their analysis, it did nevertheless acknowledge that although the Calvary Chapel churches share a name, the individual church applicants are each distinct legal entities. The applicants told the FCC that they, quote, have no agreements or understandings of any type with CSN, Calvary Chapel at Twin Falls, or any other Calvary Chapel church regarding programming to be broadcast, end quote. And an interesting thing about the Calvary Chapel churches is that they're run almost in like a franchise fashion. So unlike a church like the Catholic Church, which is divided up into dioceses who then are divided up into their sub-parishes, Calvary Chapel churches are run by individual pastors who get their certification of sorts from the central Calvary Chapel body, but that each church is individually run and operated and run by individual pastors. So any individual pastor, if they leave a church, the church quits being part of the Calvary Chapel church network and needs to get another Calvary Chapel licensed or agreed upon pastor. And they seem to be taking the same tact with their radio stations, in that each individual church is going ahead to get their own low-power FM station, but is each doing so on its own. And again, to be fair, the FCC probably has licensed Catholic churches and other denominational churches to have their own low-power FM stations operating within their own community, regardless of the fact that if it's a Catholic church, it's part of the larger Catholic infrastructure, or if it's a United Church of Christ, similarly part of this larger church nationwide. But what's interesting, of course, about Calvary Chapel is that it is so identified with CSN International, the owner of 404 stations nationwide, the closest to Champaign-Urbana being at 90.5 in Decatur, Illinois. And that is a translator station operating at less than 100 watts. And unlike a low-power FM station, it may not broadcast local content and may only rebroadcast KAWZ out of Twin Falls, Idaho. Interesting things going on at the FCC. And so some more FCC news. And this one is today, the FCC made a unanimous decision, which is rather unusual, given that right now there are two Republicans and two Democrats on the commission, which is otherwise poised for a deadlock on a lot of issues. They came to consensus to end what Chairman Kevin Martin called the, quote, regulatory inequities that currently exist between cable and telephone companies that who provide broadband internet services, end quote. And what this basically does is that competitors to companies like SBC, Ameritech, are no longer allowed or will no longer be able to get guaranteed access at government-mandated rates to their DSL or digital internet service. So right now, SBC has to provide competitors like McLeod USA access to their lines to offer DSL service to customers in the home or to business customers. And the whole logic behind that mandate was the fact that companies like SBC, which was previously Ameritech and which was previously Illinois Bell, had a large incumbency advantage because they had at one point been part of the national monopoly of the Bell system and AT&T. They were able to lay down all sorts of lines without any fear of competition since they had a legal monopoly. Since that time, and that competition has been opened up for telecommunications services, it has still been difficult for competitors to enter into DSL service where the incumbents already had these large first-mover advantages. But now, the FCC, strangely by unanimous vote, decided that that would no longer be required that SBC offer access to the likes of McLeod USA and other companies to their DSL lines. Of course, consumer advocates are criticizing this deregulation. Janine Kenny, who is a senior policy analyst for the Consumers Union, said, quote, "What it means is you've got two players, two big market players, cable and telephone companies, controlling right now the primary two types of broadband service into the home. And that takes into account that most cable companies also have a local monopoly. And so typically you have two operators of internet service in a lot of cities, especially smaller cities. You have your DSL from your incumbent telephone company and you have cable modem." What's interesting is that they're able to get the Democrats on board with this ruling, and they were brought on board due to some other points which they fought for, which included help for rural internet access and a homeland security provision to help law enforcement and protections for the disabled. And, you know, this whole fairness argument comes from the fact that cable companies are not forced to give access to competitors to their high-speed lines. So your cable company is regulated differently from your telephone company. And this, of course, is a sort of regulation anomaly dating back from a time when video was video and voice was voice and data was data. But in the internet world, of course, we have all learned that these have all become the same thing. They are all data and they all can move over the same type of lines, whether they happen to be the coaxial line going into your house from your, for your cable television, or whether it is over copper lines of the telephone company. So that is sort of an interesting change here. But the FCC, it is amazing that they're able to make this decision, because Kevin Martin has been trying to add this to their docket, and they had a meeting today. And in fact, delay the meeting a day in order to find a consensus amongst the FCC commissioners so that they would not be caught in a deadlock during the meeting. This sort of is very different from the Michael Powell administration at the FCC just a year ago or 2 years ago, when decisions were made by consistent 3-2 Republican to Democrat majority votes, where he didn't have to find a consensus with all of the FCC commissioners because he had a guaranteed Republican majority. But right now, the FCC is missing one commissioner, Michael Powell, who retired earlier in the year and who has not been replaced, because his replacement requires selection by the president and then confirmation by the Senate. And we know that confirmation hearings in the Senate have not been going quickly at all this year. And by all accounts, the confirmation of new FCC commissioners is not at the top of the Bush administration's list. Also to be replaced is Kathleen Abernathy, who is the other Republican currently on the commission, who intends to leave the commission, whose term is up this year. But because there is no replacement, she is allowed to stay on the commission through the end of the year, though certainly she would like to get out as soon as she can because her term is over. But otherwise, anything that's very controversial at the FCC is blocked. There's not very much that's going to get through, because at the very best they can hope for on the Republican side is a 2-2 vote. And of course, when you're not the party in power like the Democrats, you don't often hope to get very much past the FCC, unless, of course, you know it shares very strong bipartisan support. Now, there was some hope last week that perhaps the Bush administration would be making known its two nominees for the FCC before the congressional term ended, and that did not materialize. But currently, the buzz on the street in Washington points to two people who may be appointed. One is Richard Russell, who was a White House advisor, and Deborah Tate, who serves on the Tennessee Regulatory Authority. And apparently she is close to Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist. And they're basically career Republican technocrats. There's nothing currently in any reports really clearly indicates their leanings on regulatory issues, although they do seem to be loyal party members and technocrats. Very similar, one might add, to Kevin Martin, who is the current chair of the FCC. But one thing Kevin Martin is showing right now that Michael Powell did not show is he's showing an unusual willingness to compromise, even with the Democrats, to try and get their vote, and showing a softer touch in pushing his agenda forward. One of the things that is on the FCC agenda right now is a new look at the ownership rules, at media ownership rules, since the last go-around was struck down by the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, and the Supreme Court refused to hear a challenge to that decision. They have to go at it again, but it's certainly nothing which the FCC wants to do in a situation where the Republicans cannot push forward too much. And the Democrats are pushing for much more public and open scrutiny of the process, and they are pushing for hearings, public hearings, which Michael Powell refused to have. So this is going to be interesting times to the FCC to see if what they can get done until the Bush administration is able to put forward any commissioners. One also discussion going on, or some rumors going around Washington, is that something which may be holding up the process a little bit is the reappointment of Michael Copps, who is the outspoken sort of old school Democrat on the Federal Communications Commission. He is one who was very outspoken about the media ownership rules and being upset about how much was given away to the media giants. He's also been outspoken on the issue of indecency, and has been for a very long time, as being very critical of the amount of indecency on the airwaves. And there's the wind seemed to blow in various directions with regard to his being reappointed to the commission. He has strong support amongst powerful Democrats in Congress, which gives a strong indication that he will be reappointed. Although there's also some rumors about that the White House would like to find a different Democrat to replace him, but that might be difficult because that other Democrat should have the support of congressional Democrats as well. Also, there are some sort of technocratic or bureaucratic delays in that the Senate Commerce Committee, which oversees the FCC, would like to see a whole package of nominations come through rather than deal with them one at a time. So they would like to see the replacement for Kathleen Abernathy, the replacement for Michael Powell, and the possible renomination of Michael Copps altogether rather than seeing them come through dribbed and drabbed one at a time. But as it looks now, the FCC isn't going to see any new members until at least the next session of Congress begins. And in other news, also with the FCC, the Campaign Legal Center joined the Institute of Public Representation, the Office of Communications of the United Church of Christ, the National Hispanic Media Coalition, the Media Access Project, the Benton Foundation, Chicago Media Action, and Free Press in filing comments calling on the FCC to strengthen the rules governing the public notice station owners must give when they apply to transfer their broadcast station license. The comments recommend that the FCC create a specific website where listeners and viewers can access information about proposed station sales and submit comments or objections. The groups urge the FCC to ensure that the rules maximize public participation in the broadcast licensing process. And what's interesting about this is that there is this market in buying and selling broadcast licenses, even though a broadcast license in the FM band or the TV band up until very recently was free, given by the federal government to an entity to have a broadcast station. And recently, commercial radio licenses have started to be auctioned off by the federal government. But that's a very new thing. Most of the broadcast licenses that currently exist out there were given for free and yet have a market value and can be sold and transferred. But the transfer process is not necessarily pro forma, although in most cases, it does end up being this way. And this is certainly a move by many media reform and public interest groups to try and insert more public scrutiny and in the realm of the public interest into this process. Because if your local FM station gets sold, perhaps maybe from a smaller local owner to a larger owner like Clear Channel, that may be something which you've a great interest in, either because you think the programming will change, you're worried that, like a lot of Clear Channel stations, you may end up having no local hosts and no local news when it's all over as the programs come piped out of Indianapolis or some other city, rather than your local community. And so what these groups are saying is you ought to have the ability to chime in about that, actually, and say, we think that this would not be in the interest of our local community for there to be this transfer, or we challenge the new owner to prove that they will provide the same level of local service we become accustomed to with the previous station. Now, I'm certain that the National Association of Broadcasters will do their best to fight this filing, because it's the last thing they want to see is more impediments put in the way of the easy trade in broadcast licenses, which not only allow companies to amass large empires like Clear Channel's 1200 station, but can be very, very lucrative, where even in small markets like Champaign-Urbana, where Media Geek originates, licenses have gone for as much as $7 million. And that's not too bad for something which was free from the federal government. And one last note here, was not able to bring you an interview today with Jake Sexton, who does a website, blog, and radio show called Lying Media Bastards out in San Diego. But I do want to bring you a little bit of news that pops up in that interview, and that there was another FCC bust in San Diego of an unlicensed FM radio station. This other station is known only as 106.9 FM. And this station was only rebroadcasting the internet stream of Radioactive San Diego, which is an online-only local internet radio station where Jake does his program Lying Media Bastards. And actually, 106.9, I misspoke, really wasn't busted, but they received a letter from the FCC, a cease and desist of sorts, telling them that they had to go off the air within the next 10 days or face $10,000 in fines. And it's an interesting situation since Radioactive San Diego and the operators of 106.9 FM don't know each other, are essentially two different organizations or two different sets of people. Radioactive really only intends to be an internet station, but someone locally in San Diego, California, where there is no community radio to speak of, decided that this station should be on the airwaves and decided to put it up. And this comes just 2 weeks after Free Radio San Diego was busted by the FCC and the federal marshals who came into their station while there was no one there and seized all of the equipment, taking that three-year-old Free Radio station off the air. So there seems to be a bit of FCC activity continuing to go on in San Diego and around with regard to unlicensed radio, free radio, Radio Free Brattleboro having been taken off the air just a month ago as well. And you'll hear more about that next week when we bring you an interview with Jake Sexton, who does the blog and website and radio show Lying Media Bastards. That brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. We'll be back in 1 week with more news and views on our media environment. In the meantime, check out Media Geek on the web at www.mediageek.org. There you can read the Media Geek blog for news that can't fit onto the show, as well as download archive episodes of the program in MP3 in the open-source Ogg Vorbis format. If you have any comments about the program, please send them to paul@mediageek.org. I'm host and executive producer Paul Riesmandel. Our producer is Drew Tirico. Media Geek is produced live at community radio station WEFT in Champaign, Illinois. Some pre-production happens at the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center. Media Geek is also heard on KRFP, Radio Free Moscow in Moscow, Idaho, and on KQRP in Salida, California. And Media Geek is free to broadcast on your local non-commercial station, too. To inquire, please send email to paul@mediageek.org. Thanks for tuning in.